It's gonna be scary. Not for us.
All engine running. Lift off.
Start on Thompson, steps right, shoots for the win of three. He got it! He got it!
This ain't my first rodeo.
Westbrook to the basket. Turns Schroeder around. Russell Westbrook.
House the three and the lead. You betcha.
Covington, biggest shot of the game, and he hits it. The corner, PJ Tucker. Gordon by Gordon Ridge.
It's time to accomplish something together that we haven't accomplished before.
We both understand that we have one common goal, and that's to win a championship, so.
Let's get it.
What is up, and welcome to another episode of Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Today's episode is brought to you by Built Bar. Built Bar is a protein bar that actually tastes like a candy bar. You can go to builtbar.com and use promo code LOCKEDON, and you'll actually get $10 off your first order. Now, as always, I am your host, Jackson Gatlin. You can catch me on Twitter at JT Gatlin. And of course, our show is also on Twitter at Locked On Rockets. And if you appreciate what we do here at Locked On Rockets, all the Rockets content, the guests, please do me a favor and hit that subscribe button, drop us a review, leave some stars, and above all else, share the podcast on all your social media platforms. I would sincerely appreciate it. Now, before we get to our special guest for today's show, I do have a couple 2020 graduation shout-outs that I'd like to do. So the first of which goes to Brian Dukes, who has finished his time at Lone Star College, getting ready to transfer to the University of Houston as he finishes his cybersecurity degree. Congrats, Brian, on making it through the Lone Star College portion of your collegiate career. And Brian wants to remind people about the Rockets subreddit, which I give the Rockets subreddit quite a bit of credit here on the podcast. You know, I talk about them a lot. I also, you know, sling some things from the Rockets sub onto Twitter from time to time. And Brian just wants to remind everybody that that's a great place to discuss the Rockets with other diehard fans, so be sure to check that out. And then my second shout-out goes to Raven Binkley, the wife of LaShard Binkley, a guy who's been on this podcast recently. She just graduated with high honors for cancer information management from Southwest Tech, so congrats to Brian, congrats to Raven. Proud of both of you guys, and you know, 2020 is a weird year where you're not really able to walk across the stage and graduate in a traditional sense. So I just wanted to be able to give them both a quick shout out here on the show. If you have any graduates that you'd like to shout out, please let me know. Reach out to me on Twitter or through my email, jacksontgatlin@gmail.com. And I'd be happy to give somebody a shout out for their graduation here in 2020. Now, as we get to our special guest today, this is a guy that a lot of you guys know and love, a man who is famous for the three is greater than two phrase, our very own former Rocket and current Rockets broadcaster, Matt Bullard. How's it going today, Matt?
I'm doing pretty good. You know, a lot of crazy stuff going on in the world and a lot of important stuff to pay attention to. But one of the things that makes it all better is talking sports. And so I'm glad to be on them.
Absolutely. I think that one thing that's important to remember, and I think that The Last Dance kind of gave us a little bit of that, is, you know, sports can serve as a distraction, you know, to kind of get away from some of the problems in everyday life. And, you know, we've been dealing with the COVID pandemic, and now we're dealing with a pretty big issue as well with the protesting going on in many major cities across the United States. And that's not to say that we need a distraction from those things, but, you know, sports can serve as an avenue for others who, you know, do need to take a moment to be able to take their minds off of some of the bigger world issues and kind of just be able to relax for a moment before they get back to the important stuff.
And I also think sports can bring us all together. You know, it's like a unifying thing as well. And also, you know, NBA in particular, I think, has done a terrific job of being a good leader in our society. And you know, all the NBA players that have been speaking out, and Adam Silver has been a terrific commissioner so far. As the NBA is trying to get back up to speed and playing, there's, you know, the social issues. I'm very proud of the NBA and everybody who's speaking up and speaking out.
Absolutely. You know, I've said for a long time, both to people who, you know, aren't as familiar with sports, you know, kind of as I'm trying to ease them into my fandom for the NBA and others who are, you know, fanatics of the NBA. I've said for a long time that, you know, Adam Silver has done a phenomenal job, and I think is, you know, far and above probably the best commissioner of the three major sports leagues that we often concern ourselves with here in the States, between the MLB, NFL, and NBA, as far as empowering the players, the freedom of speech that he allows, you know, those kinds of things. It seems like time and time again, he's been faced with these really tough decisions as commissioner and has come out on top every single time with what feels like the right decision for the league as a whole. Do you agree?
Oh, for sure. And I'll give you one little Adam Silver story. It was several years back when Dwight Howard was playing for the Rockets. I remember Hackett Dwight, you know, everybody was fouling Dwight and putting him on the free throw line. And Adam Silver was at one of our games. And it was before the game started. I was down on the floor getting ready to do my game open on TV. And Adam Silver and Mark Tatum, his deputy, comes right. They came right up to me and said, "Hey, man, how you doing?" And we started talking about Hackett Dwight. And I said, "You know, what are you going to do about that?" And Adam says, "Well, what do you think?" And it was very interesting to me that as the commissioner of the league, he found my perspective important and wanted to listen to it. And so that's the one character quality that Adam Silver has, is he wants to listen. He wants to listen to all different kinds of perspectives, all different kinds of experts, and then he'll be able to make a smarter decision on his own. And I think that's what we're seeing now with him trying to get the league back up and playing in the middle of this pandemic, is he's listening to a lot of perspectives and a lot of experts, and that will really help him make the smartest decision.
Absolutely. Now, please tell me you had a chance to pitch your fourth referee idea to him at some point.
Yeah, that was further on in the conversation. And I have talked to a lot of people in the NBA about that fourth referee idea. And also I've talked to some officials about it. And a lot of them kind of liked it, but no one's really been as excited about it as I am. Even though, you know, adding a fourth referee at the press table who has video review capabilities, that would get all the calls right. And it would also add another job to the officiating crew. So I thought it was a win-win, but I'll keep pushing.
Absolutely. We need you to keep pushing. Every time you bring it up on the broadcast, I get excited thinking about the idea of, you know, getting every single call right. Now, you know, where I do want to get to, though, before we dive too far down the rabbit hole that is NBA officiating, which that's definitely a rabbit hole, is I want to kind of revisit the 90s Rockets and kind of ask you some questions about those 90 teams that you started your career off with and that a lot of Rockets fans, you know and hold so dearly, you know, in their heart. And my first question to you really is, just how was it transitioning from Don Chaney to Rudy T? Like, were their coaching styles drastically different? And how hard was it switching coaches in the middle of, you know, an NBA season between Chaney to Rudy T, as opposed to having an off season to get acclimated?
Yeah, it's a good question. And 1990 was my first year. And that was the year that Don Chaney won Coach of the Year. And so my first year in the NBA was playing for a guy who did a terrific job coaching the team. And then in the middle of my second year is when Don got fired and Rudy was made the head coach. And I remember that conversation the day that Don Chaney got fired. Steve Patterson was the general manager, and he came in and had a meeting with all the players in the locker room before practice. And he said, "You know what, guys?" He said, "You guys got a good man fired today. Don Chaney's a good man. He's a good coach. He doesn't deserve what he got. But since you guys aren't doing your job, you got a good man fired." And, you know, I'm a young kid just starting off in the league, and I'm thinking, my eyes are all wide. And I'm thinking, oh man, this is for real business in here. Like, this is a cutthroat type deal.
Yeah.
But I remember Rudy taking over the job. And of course, you know, since Rudy was an assistant, I was working with Rudy on a daily basis, trying to get better. So I had a good relationship with him already. And when he became the head coach, that good relationship that I had with him and all the other players had with him was a big advantage for him, because everybody knew him. Everybody knew what to expect. He wasn't that much different than Don Chaney as far as his personality. You know, both Don and Rudy were great players in this league. And I feel like both Don and Rudy were good coaches because they were players and they knew the player perspective and knew what it was like to try to do this job on a night after night basis. And so when Rudy took over, it was just a different voice. It was all the same plays and all the same schemes and everything. But of course, Rudy had the underlying talent that nobody really knew at the time when he got that job. But, man, I'll tell you what, heart of a champion, and now Rudy's a Hall of Famer, well-deserved. What a career he's had. And just thinking back to that, when he first got that job, that's a long time ago, but those memories are still fresh in my mind.
And, you know, speaking of heart of a champion and, you know, getting rolling things along and, you know, as as the team got used to Rudy T as the coach, you know, we get along to that 93-94 season, the first season that, you know, the first season of back-to-back titles. To start off that season, I don't know if a lot of people know, but that season started with a 15-game winning streak, you know, starting out the gates 15-0, and then also, you know, moving on to being, eventually it was like 22 games with only one loss or something like that. A hell of a start to that season. What was going on behind the scenes that got you guys off to such a hot start that year?
Well, I'm going to rewind it to the previous season. And the previous season in 92-93, we had a terrific team, the same team that won the championship in the following year. But we always had a hard time getting past the Seattle Supersonics. And the Supersonics back then were Gary Payton, Sean Kemp, Detlef Schrempf, Sam Perkins, Nate McMillan. Those guys had a terrific team, and George Carl was their coach. And they had a defensive scheme that was geared to stopping the Houston Rockets. And we really struggled with playing against their defense. It was the one team that we really didn't have an advantage against. And so in the playoffs in 93, the year before we won the championship, we met the Seattle Supersonics. They had the home court advantage. The series went to 7 games, and we lost in overtime in game 7 in Seattle to get eliminated from those playoffs. And I remember the plane ride back after that game was the quietest plane ride I've ever been on. That pain that we all felt from that loss, I still have in my heart. I can still feel that pain to this day. But it was that loss that drove us through the summer to come back the following year and rip off 15 in a row to start the season and go 22-1. And it was that disappointment and that pain. And Rudy talked about it to me a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about this. He says, you know, Bull, he goes, nothing good in life comes without some pain and some suffering. And so, you know, that's sort of Rudy's philosophy, is that you have to go through some hard times in order to get to the good times. Had we not gotten beat by the Seattle Supersonics in that series in 93, I think we would have beaten the Bulls in the finals. And the Rockets would be the one to have three-peated in the mid-90s. But Seattle knocked us off. We came back the following year, and we used that pain that we felt to drive us through that first championship season.
Coming up, I do want to talk to Matt about some hard times as that season progressed and had to deal with not one, but two different 7-game series on the way to the Rockets' first championship. And we'll get there in just a second. But first, I have a quick message from our friends over at Built Bars. Look, whether you're trying to get shredded like Russell Flexbrook, or whether you're trying to just drop some poundage like the new Slim Jim Harden, Built Bar can help you do that. Look, I mean, they've got 16 amazing, great flavors. These protein bars they're not protein bars, right? I mean, basically, they're like candy bars. You know, like I could fly through a whole box of these things because it's like eating a freaking candy bar. That's all I could say about it. I mean, it's not all I can say about it. It's a bunch of different great things I can say about it. But that's the main point, right? Is look, when I used to think protein bars, I used to think, oh, gross, I don't want to eat a protein bar. That's not like that with Built Bars. With Built Bars, it's actually something that I look forward to. When I realize that I've packed up a couple to take to work, or, you know, if I'm working out, now that my gym is back open at my apartment, thank goodness, I'm able to actually, you know, grab a protein bar, knock that back, and, you know, head down to the gym for my workout session. And look, you guys can try these protein bars too. All you have to do is go to builtbar.com and use promo code LOCKEDON, and you'll actually get $10 off your first order. Do me a favor, try the double chocolate mousse ones. You cannot go wrong with those. They're my absolute favorite. Please check them out. Just remember to use promo code LOCKEDON for $10 off your very first order at builtbar.com. And we are back in here at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball, chatting with Matt Bullard. Now, Matt, that year, actually, before I get to the playoffs from that season, I do want to know, you know, as a player, do you guys, like, back in the day, do you ever remember, like, looking at, say, the standings, and, you know, you just look down and you're like, hey, guys, you know, we haven't lost in a while. Do players really pay attention to that, or is that something that, you know, is more fan and media centric?
Yeah, I think fans and the media look at those kind of streaks and those types of things a little bit more, because when you're in the season plan, you're so busy preparing for the next game that you really don't have time to look up and look in the standings. And back then, of course, we didn't have the internet. So if you wanted to look at the standings, you had to look at the newspaper. You know, you had to actually open up the newspaper and find the standings and see where you were at. So, you know, when we were going through those streaks, we had won 15 in a row. And that 15th game was in New York City. And the Knicks have been talking a little trash about how they were going to end our streak. And those types of things we were aware of. That we knew we were on the streak. We knew the New York Knicks were laying there waiting on us to come into New York and try to knock us off. And we just blasted them in that 15th game. And it was, that win right there in New York City against the Knicks, who was the team that we ended up beating in the finals, looking back on it. But, we didn't know that at the time, but we knew that was a big win. And our airplane going to Atlanta for the next night, it was a back-to-back, Knicks-Hawks back-to-back. We had terrible travel problems getting from New York to Atlanta. We didn't land in Atlanta until like 5 in the morning. We had Atlanta airport was closed. We had to walk through like 6 different terminals to get to where we were going. So by the time we played the Atlanta Hawks the next night, we were exhausted. And we lost that game to the Hawks because of the travel situation. And then we ended up going 22-1 before we lost again. But even though we didn't know really what the numbers are on the streak, we did know by that time that we were a good team. And we could feel it. We knew that we had what it took. We knew we were rolling. Everybody knew their jobs. Everybody was clicking. Everyone was playing well. And to think back on those stretches in your career when you're on a team that's playing that well, it's pretty rare. And so it does stand out in my memory to think back about that winning streak.
Now, as I was trying to get into originally before asking that question, the playoffs that year, you guys went through the Blazers 3-1, the Suns, a 7-game series, 4-3, the Jazz in the Western Conference Finals, 4-1, and then lastly, the Knicks in the finals to win the chip that first time, 4-3. Of those 2 7-game series, which was harder that year, the Suns or the Knicks, and why?
Well, I'm going to say the Knicks for sure. I mean, the 7-game series against the Knicks in the finals, I've never felt that kind of pressure in my life, and I haven't felt it since. When you're playing in Madison Square Garden in the finals, I could just feel the pressure on my shoulders. When you're out there playing, you can just feel the gravity of the situation, the weight of the game. And it took everything we had to beat the Knicks in 7 games. And thankfully, the Rockets had a home court advantage in that series because we ended up coming back to Houston. Back then, it was 2 games at home, and then we played 3 games in New York, and then we came back for the last 2 home games in Houston, and we came back down 3-2. So we had to win those final 2 games at home to win the championship, and we were able to do that in front of the home crowd, and the fans in the Summit really helped us out. But I will point out that series against the Phoenix Suns, where we won 4-3, that was where Clutch City was born. We had home court against the Suns. We blew 20-point leads in the fourth quarter in the first 2 games against the Suns. So when we flew off to go to Phoenix to play the next 2 games out there, the Houston Chronicle called us Choke City. Big, huge headline, Choke City. And I remember what that felt like for all of us as we landed in Phoenix and found out that our hometown newspaper had called us Chokers. And so that particular feeling was not good. And that's sort of what Rudy talks about is some of the pain you have to go through in order to find good stuff. But we had to break through that those first 2 losses and break through that Choke City name to turn it into Clutch City. And so, even though the Knicks series was probably a more difficult series to win, that series against the Phoenix Suns is really what solidified our persona and brought Clutch City to life.
Now, for those that may not know this, the rivalry between Hakeem and Patrick Ewing stretched all the way back to their college days. And so I want to know, did Hakeem ever vocalize his desire to beat Ewing because of losing the national championship back in college?
No, he never did mention that. Hakeem, I'm sure Hakeem knew in the back of his mind. I'm sure he was using that as a driving force. But he never really talked about stuff like that. Hakeem, when he spoke, he didn't speak very often, but when he spoke, his words carried a lot of weight with us. But he was leading us by example. What he was doing on a daily basis, coming to practice, playing as hard as he can in practice. Here's a story that I have from my first season with the Rockets. Of course, Hakeem's been with the Rockets for several years. I'm a rookie coming in, and I'm trying to get on the practice court to play as much as I can. When we're scrimmaging, I'm trying to get out there to get some reps and try to get better and try to show the coaches that I deserve to play. And so one time Hakeem came out to get a drink, and so I jump on the floor real quick to try to play as much as I can. And as soon as Hakeem caught his breath, he looked at me on the floor, and he goes, "Hey, you." number 50. I got you. Here I am, a rookie. He doesn't even know my name, and he's subbing himself back in into practice. And so he was leading us by example. He was the guy who was working the hardest in practice. He was the guy that was carrying us in the games. And so it was really easy to fall in line behind our leader and just follow what he was doing. And he didn't do it with a lot of words. He didn't speak a lot. He just did it with his actions.
If you had to pick one word to describe Hakeem, what would it be?
That's a good question, because I played 9 years with Hakeem. Out of all of his teammates that he's had with the Rockets, I've played the most games with him. So I knew Hakeem in the early 90s when he was Hakeem, started with an A, you know, A-K-E-E-M. Mm-hmm. And then I also know Hakeem after he rededicated himself to Islam and became Hakeem, started with an H. Spelled his first name differently to make it more accurate for who he was. And so I saw the transformation in his life, going from an undisciplined, he would fight all the time in games. He would cuss and swear, and he would cuss out the officials. And then one summer he came back and he was a totally different person, very disciplined, very respectful, very humble. And so, and that transformation that he went through also coincided with us winning championships. And so in his 10th year, after he had rededicated himself to Islam, we win two championships back to back. And so I don't know if there's really one word that I can say to describe Hakeem, maybe like noble or, humble or, those types of words. He, really one of the greatest human beings I've ever been around, I've known him, back when he was a young, wild kid, and all of us grow up for sure. I grew up as well, following what I saw, what Hakeem was doing. What Hakeem was doing was teaching me how to be a pro, and I was following his example. And so he's a very complex man, a very prideful man. He's got a great family. He's built a great life. And, of course, he had a Hall of Fame basketball career, which is probably, in his mind, probably not one of his greatest accomplishments. But he's a very complex man, so I don't think there's one word that really describes him.
That's a fair point, and I appreciate the highlighting there of his transformation, and his newfound faith in Islam. And I think that's a story that probably doesn't get enough attention, from Hakeem's career. Now, coming up, I do want to talk about what I think is one of the most impressive individual seasons in NBA history, and we'll get there in just one second after a quick word from our friends at Blinkist. Let me tell you guys about pretty much just one of the ultimate life hacks. Look, Blinkist, it works on your phone, your tablet, your web browser. It takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them down into just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. 12 million people are using Blinkist right now and has a massive and growing library from self-help or business or health history books, you name it, Blinkist has it. And they have all the latest titles from bestsellers lists, as well as all the classic nonfiction titles that you always meant to read, but never quite had the time to. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to this massive library of condensed nonfiction books, all the books you want, all for one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. You can go to Blinkist.com/MBA and try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/MBA to start your free 7-day trial. And remember, you'll save 25% off, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/MBA. And we are back in here for our final segment at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day, chatting with former Rockets player and now current Rockets broadcaster, Matt Bullard. So, Matt, to me, that 94 season has got to be, to me, I think it's got to be the most impressive individual season in NBA history for Hakeem Olajuwon, finishing with the MVP, DPOY, Finals MVP, and to top it all off with a ring. What do you think about that season? Is it the most impressive individual season?
Yeah, for sure. To win all those awards, to just dominate the way he did on both ends of the floor, and so like I'm sitting on the bench, right? And I'm watching Hakeem play from the front row night after night after night. And he's carrying us on the offensive end. He's getting double teamed every single time he touches the ball. He's making the right plays, making the right passes. And then on the defensive end, he's completely shutting down the other team's offense by himself. You know, like Akeem was a guy who not only led the league in blocks, but he also led the league in steals. So you got the 7-foot guy who's blocking shots at the rim, but also able to jump out on the floor and steal the ball from the guards or intercept passes. His combination of athleticism and size is unheard of in the NBA. We haven't seen another player like him at his size. And so for him to have the kind of season that he had and then finishing it, you know, individual awards for sure, but then finishing it off with the biggest championship is very impressive. But the one thing I will say about Akeem through all of that year is when he got those awards, he brought his entire team out with him. All of his teammates, he wanted out on the floor to receive those awards. And he even though they were individual awards, he gave the credit to us, his teammates, to help him get to where he was. And that says a lot about his character, about how he was not really that interested in individual awards. He was all about the team. And even though he was the best player on the floor in that season, in the NBA, especially because Michael Jordan was playing baseball that year, it's really cool to look back. I get goosebumps right now just thinking about how cool it was to be on the floor with Akeem when he gets the MVP trophy and he hands it off to Otis Thorpe. And so you see all the pictures with Otis holding the MVP trophy, and you know Akeem had won it, but he was like sharing it with all of us. And that was, that's not only a great example of how to do it, but like I say, it still feels great to this day to be a part of that.
Definitely seems like it speaks volumes about the type of man he was and still is, you know, just so really, I think you were right when you threw out the word humble, you know, earlier on kind of describing him. And speaking of Michael Jordan's short-lived baseball career, first things first, did you enjoy The Last Dance?
Yeah, I really did enjoy it. You know, it was great. It jogged a lot of great memories for me and all the guys that were in, you know, all the Chicago Bulls, you know, Steve Kerr and Judd Bushler and Scottie Pippen and all those guys, Dennis Rodman. You know, I played my whole career against those guys. So it jogged a lot of memories for me that weren't even shown on the Last Dance documentary. But the other cool thing about it was my kids were born in the late 90s. And so they did not really see me play. And so we were able to watch that Last Dance together. And I would pause it and I would tell them a story, you know, about, you know, what it jogged my memory. And so I was able to share sort of my playing career with them now that they're in their 20s, you know, now that they're adults. I was able to go back in time and kind of fill in their knowledge a little bit about how Dad used to play in the NBA. So not only was it great to see, you know, the Bulls and Michael Jordan and see that story, but it was also great to share that with my kids.
Definitely. And I think that's something that a lot of people are experiencing, because I'm on the younger end of spectrum as far as, you know, Rockets fans or Rockets media is concerned. And, you know, I'll be 25 on June 21st. So I was born in 1995, right in the middle, you know, of the 90s. So I didn't get to experience the 90s to that extent, similar to your kids. And so being able to go back and kind of relive some of that, you know, through the scope of this really well done documentary was a phenomenal experience. Now, here's the question, though, is, you know, The Last Dance did drum up quite a bit of buzz surrounding some of those 90s what ifs. So how do you feel regarding that argument that the Rockets have asterisks around their championships just because Jordan was retired?
Yeah, you know, it's a great argument. It's certainly has produced a lot of words on, you know, on people talking about it. But, yeah. But the numbers show that, you know, the Rockets were 5-1 against the Bulls when the Bulls won their first 3 championships. And I already told you about the story when the Rockets got knocked out by the Seattle Supersonics. Otherwise, we would have beaten them in 93. So the Rockets had the formula to beat the Bulls. We had Vernon Maxwell and Mario Elie to guard Michael Jordan, and they had Bill Cartwright to guard Hakeem Olajuwon. So the advantage that we had with the Dream over their team really did bear, you know, we were 5-1 against them. And so the Bulls are just lucky that they did not face the Rockets in the finals, because we would have beaten them. And, you know, and then of course in 95, when the Rockets won their second championship, Michael Jordan was actually playing that year, and the Orlando Magic knocked the Bulls out in the Eastern Conference Finals. And if you look at Jordan's numbers, his numbers that he put up in the playoffs that year were better than the numbers he put up in 96 when they won the championship again. So, you know, it is fun to talk about what ifs. The Rockets certainly would have beaten the Bulls if we had faced them in the finals. And then the other thing that I would like to point out about that era in the NBA, and we got to see it on The Last Dance, was just how different the game is today than what it was back in the 90s. You know, it was so physical back in the 90s. The part of the documentary that showed the Bad Boys and how physical they played and how they were just trying to beat Michael Jordan up. And in the games that we played against the Knicks in the finals were like wrestling matches, super physical games, guys just really being as physical as possible, no fouls called. And now the game today, with it being much faster, higher scoring, way more space to operate, a lot more three-point shooting, a lot more fast breaking. To me, the game is a lot more fun to watch now than it was back in the 90s. And so it really was kind of, a good reminder for me, but also for my kids to see just how physical the game was back in the 90s.
And I know I'm sure everybody listening knows that you're a bit jealous that you're not playing in today's NBA as opposed to the late 90s, right?
No doubt. I mean, Rudy T was way ahead of his time when he used Robert Horry and myself to spread the floor, to be the original stretch four, to make space for Akeem to be able to operate in the post and have Robert and I shoot threes. So Rudy deserves all the credit for figuring that out. But I tell Mike D'Antoni all the time, I said, if I can find some HGH and turn my clock back 25 years, I would love to play for you in the current Rockets offense, because the way he's maximizing the three-point shots and the Rockets generate the most open threes of any team in the NBA, oh, man, I, if there's some way for me to turn my clock back, I'm doing it.
And you wouldn't even be a stretch four. You'd be the Rockets' five out. You'd be their center shooting threes.
Yeah, no doubt. It'd be so much fun. I can just picture myself out there just getting wide open looks time after time. But unfortunately, that's not the way it works. So I just get to sit on the side and talk about it and enjoy it.
And that is going to be where we wrap up our show for today. Please be on the lookout for part two of our conversation with Matt Bullard coming out shortly. And as always, thank you all so much for listening very, very much. And I look forward to having you back right here at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball.